For the privilege to broadcast this summer's London Olympics, NBC paid more than $1 billion, $1.18 billion to be exact. As part of that deal, the network gets the right to stream the entire Olympic Games, every event, live, online. It's going to be the first time American viewers will be able to see all the games live rather than have the network tape delay games for primetime broadcast. We're going to talk about this with John Arand. He's the media reporter at Sports Business Daily. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It is 2012. You surprised this didn't happen sooner?
Oh, very surprised. I'm surprised it didn't happen 4 years ago or even 8 years ago. It's established that people are watching video online, and people also are rejecting tape-delayed broadcasts, which is what NBC had done 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, and 8 years ago.
Well, NBC must have noticed people being unhappy about this. Why did they resist?
They resisted because they were worried that by putting everything out online, it could potentially dilute the audience of their primetime program. And if they dilute that audience, all of a sudden the ad rates are going to go down and they're going to get less viewers for the primetime. And that's really what drives this whole deal.
What showed them that there might be a different way to go here?
4 years ago in Beijing, Usain Bolt had a thrilling race where he set the world record in the 100-meter dash. That was seen on pirated sites almost instantaneously. You could go to any sports blog and you would have been able to see video of Usain Bolt.
Well, when this Bolt race went around the world, went to America, did it actually hurt NBC then or help them?
There's a belief now in the sports media industry that it did help them because it helped market it. And so people said, wow, I saw that on a grainy video on some sports blog on my little computer screen. I want to be able to sit there in my high-def TV in my den and really watch it in perfect quality.
Oh, so the thought is that this may actually drive more primetime viewers or at least not cost any?
That's what other networks are finding. They're finding that sports ratings are increasing, even as there's more video that's being made live online.
You know, this is a biennial story or quadrennial story, depending on the way you think of it. But it is often pointed out that as much as NBC pays for the Olympics, it doesn't seem like they necessarily make that money back. It's a money loser. Is that actually correct? And are we missing something here?
Well, it's difficult to say, actually. NBC did say that they lost $223 million on the Vancouver Olympics. And when Fox and ESPN bid on the most recent Olympic Games, they bid about $1 billion in total, less than NBC bid. Hmm. And they said that where they bid, they could just barely make a profit. But it's more than just ad sales that people are looking at. If you look at NBC, they have a whole stream of cable networks like USA, CNBC, MSNBC that carry Olympic programming. And all of those networks are very widely distributed. And one of the reasons that they're widely distributed is they carry that Olympic programming, and cable operators didn't want to do without that programming.
So can you imagine a future in which the streaming of the Olympic Games actually would become bigger than the broadcast of the Olympic Games?
Well, yeah, future of, 40, 50 years from now, yeah. Absolutely. I don't see it happening, really. TV is what drives the biggest audience.
We talk about the web all the time, but TV is what people watch.
Absolutely. The digital is getting closer to TV, but if that continues, sure, 2030, 2040, you could see that, but who knows how we'll be watching anything in 2030 and 2040.
John Arand of Sports Business Daily, thanks for coming by.
I really had fun. Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The rate of home ownership in the U.S. is at its lowest level in 15 years. That news from the Census Bureau this week. During the boom, home ownership rose dramatically to nearly 70%, but millions of foreclosures have erased most of those gains. NPR's Chris Arnold reports on what may be next for the housing market.
One thing that's striking is that, yes, the home ownership rate keeps falling, but in most of the country, it's actually a very good time to buy a house.
I noticed the prices. I'm like, oh, my God, and everybody kept telling me this is the time to buy.
Ibeliz Rosa works for a state adoption agency in Boston. She's 34 years old. Her husband's a police officer.
He just said, honey, we're ready.
Thanks to the Federal Reserve, interest rates are very low right now. So combined with falling prices, that makes it even cheaper to own a house. Meanwhile, around the country, rents are rising. Rose's landlord is raising her rent again this summer, up to around $1,600 a month for a two-bedroom apartment.
Our rent is like a mortgage right now. That also motivated us to get the goal that we wanted, which is a single home.
The couple's been approved for a loan through a nonprofit housing lender called NACA, and they're in the process of buying a 3-bedroom ranch house in a suburb outside Boston. She says the house has got a nice big backyard.
I had a yard when I was growing up, and I loved it. So I wanted a yard for the girls to be able to run free and have them know what it is to be, you know, out there like that. So
the American dream of home ownership appears to be alive and well. And in most places, it also makes good financial sense again. Mark Zandi is chief economist of Moody's Analytics.
For big swaths of the United States, it now makes sense to buy and not rent.
Of course, nobody wants to see a return to the reckless lending days of the housing bubble to boost home ownership to some unnatural level. But the question going forward is, must the country return to its rate of around 64% home ownership before the bubble? It's already fallen back to 65.5%. Do we have to go back to 64%?
Absolutely not.
Bruce Marks heads up NACA, the nonprofit lender who's making the home loans at Ibelis Rosa. He thinks that lending standards have gotten too tight since the housing crash.
We've gone too far to the other extreme.
Mark says that millions of renters who are able to afford their rental payments, especially as those payments have risen, he says they should be able to qualify for home loans too if they want to. So far, though, foreclosures are outnumbering first-time homebuyers, and so that keeps pushing the home ownership rate lower. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Pfizer, one of the world's largest drug companies, will pay Brigham Young University almost $500 million to settle a patent-related lawsuit involving the company's blockbuster painkiller Celebrex. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports the settlement comes as the case was about to go to trial.
Celebrex is one of the most successful commercial drugs ever, and Brigham Young University claimed that it was entitled to more than $9 billion in royalties. The university said that's because one of its professors, Daniel Simmons, helped create Celebrex. Pfizer maintains the terms of the research agreement with the scientist had been complied with. Pfizer revealed the $450 million settlement amount in a routine regulatory filing.
I would characterize it as a sizable settlement.
But University of Kansas law professor Andrew Torrance says the number doesn't look quite so big when you consider that Celebrex has generated revenues of roughly $35 billion. Torrance says he wasn't surprised that Pfizer settled the case.
I have a suspicion that in front of a jury, a lone individual, a scientist, who everybody acknowledges had some early science leading up to the drug, was up against a gigantic company which had made $35 billion. I wouldn't want to be in the company's shoes against this lone, heroic inventor.
Detailed terms of the settlement have not been made public, but Brigham Young University says it was very, very pleased with how the matter had been resolved. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Time now for another home video recommendation from film critic Bob Mondello. This week, he's listening in on Rock Hudson and Doris Day as they make a bit of pillow talk.
The girl next door meets Mr. Beefcake and, what do you know, instant chemistry.
Look, I don't know what's bothering you, but don't take your bedroom problems out on me.
I have no bedroom problems. There's nothing in my bedroom that bothers me.
Oh, that's too bad.
Racy stuff for 1959. This was the first of three Doris Day Rock Hudson comedies, the one where they share a telephone party line, getting on each other's nerves without ever meeting, then falling in love when he pretends to be someone else. Tony Randall is the odd man out, and Thelma Ritter, the smart aleck maid.
What am I missing?
When you have to ask, believe me, you're missing it.
The Blu-ray package includes 46 pages of photos, posters, and script excerpts to go with on-disc extras that are mostly routine, a trailer, a restoration documentary, and a remarkably inept commentary track with film historians that rarely matches up with what's actually happening on screen.
I want to reference one scene that's just passed, because I think it's worth mentioning, where in order to...
While he's mentioning that scene that's gone past, he's talking over this scene of Rock Hudson trying to convince Doris Day that his alter ego in the movie sounds a little gay.
Well, there are some men who just... they're very devoted to their mothers. You know, the type that likes to collect cooking recipes or exchange bits of gossip.
Ooh, what a vicious thing to say.
Now, considering Hudson was a closeted gay actor, wouldn't you think that bit of dialogue would be worth not talking over? You'd really be better off doing your own commentary, cooing over the mid-century fashions and decor, a gold, pink, and gray kitchen, for instance, that no doubt inspired millions of renovations, and split-screen tricks and star chemistry that belong to a very specific moment in time when even the title Pillow Talk struck people as vaguely salacious. I'm Rob Mondello.
Pillow. talk, pillow talk. Another night I hear myself talk, 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 talk. Wonder how it would be to have someone to pillow talk with me. I wonder how, I wonder who. Pillow talk, pillow talk.
This is NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week's cover of The New Yorker is a witty drawing by artist Chris Ware of a playground full of young children and their watchful parents. One woman wheels in her son in a stroller, only to see that all the other parents are men. It's called Mother's Day. Here's what we learned from Françoise Mouly's new coffee table-sized book, Blown Covers. For all the memorable New Yorker covers there have been, she remembers an equally large number of covers that have not been. The rejects that were not quite on the money or a little too coarsely on the money. Mouly is the magazine's art editor, and she joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
And I gather that you have a stack of these drawings in your office that never made it onto The New Yorker.
Yes, as a foundation of what we do, every week we search for just the right image, the one that will provoke discourse, such as what you described today by Chris Ware. That's an image that will get us to talk about fathers getting involved, and obviously mothers go to the park not just to take care of their kids, but also it's a form of socializing.
There's one rejected cover that was drawn at that peak of the Diet Coke and Mentos moment when there was a viral video online which showed the exploding geyser you can make by sticking a Mento into a bottle of Diet Coke. I want you to describe the cover that never made it.
Well, the first thought by Barry Blitz, the artist who came up with this, was to show two little kids in an airplane exchanging Diet Coke and Mentos, so they're about to make an explosion and the stewardess is walking past. And then he tried it with two businessmen, and then he had the right phrasing for it, where he had two Arab-looking men passing the Mentos and Diet Coke. And now you're not mocking Arab people or casting them in a role, but you're making fun of our own fears.
It didn't make it, though.
But one of the reasons it didn't make it, it's because of the point of reference of Diet Coke and Mentos was not necessarily widely enough known. There was an age gap.
The cover of your book, Blown Covers, and I suppose, therefore, the emblematic rejected New Yorker cover, was, as I understand it, intended to represent the Catholic Church's embarrassment over the child abuse scandal. And it shows the Pope in the Marilyn Monroe pose, standing on the subway grating with his vestments flying up. Didn't make it onto the cover of the magazine.
Right, and it's a good example of the images that are sent very generously by the artists without fear of embarrassing themselves. But that image made immediate sense to me. I thought it denounced the hypocrisy of the church, not just the scandal, but the sweeping the scandals under the rug. And the rule is to not edit yourself when you're an artist proposing images to us, is let us, or at least let me, look at everything that crosses your mind, whether it's publishable or not. But then I have to show things to David Remnick, editor of the magazine. But here he happened to have been on a trip, and I had one of those rare instances that many other art directors usually have to be confronted with, which is a committee type of editing. And since I work at The New Yorker, I'm surrounded with many very wonderful and smart and funny colleagues, but they tend to be word people. And once you try to rationalize an image, you start wondering, what does the Pope have to do with Marilyn Monroe? It falls apart because it's a visceral connection.
Do you in the art department at The New Yorker or at other magazines refer to the word people as the others on the magazine?
I may not want to discuss this. Can I draw you a picture instead?
Now, I learned in the book that the Marilyn Monroe pose that's on the cover, that image of the Pope that didn't make it, and there are others. There's a female suicide bomber who is in the same pose with her chador lifted up and the dynamite sticks revealed. There's another one of a sort of an older if Marilyn Monroe, I guess, had lived, and she's quite old. I mean, this is obviously quite an iconic image still.
Well, that's exactly what the building blocks that the artists are working with, because a cartoonist has to work with cliché. A businessman carries a suitcase. And what you are hoping is that they will use those cliché to make a new point and to make you see something that you thought you understood in a new way. The challenge that they give themselves is a picture of our times.
Well, Françoise Mouly, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a real treat being here.
The book is called Blown Covers, New Yorker Covers You Were Never Meant to See. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Rupert Murdoch has long been one of the world's most powerful media barons. Yet today, members of Britain's parliament declared him unfit to run a major international company. They released a report accusing Murdoch's News Corporation of a huge failure of corporate governance. NPR's Philip Reeves has the story.
Rupert Murdoch spent six decades building his global empire. Now, in his 82nd year, he's under unprecedented attack. For months, he and his corporation have been under the intense scrutiny of a committee of British parliamentarians investigating phone hacking at Murdoch's defunct News of the World. Murdoch himself testified before the committee last year, cap in hand.
This is the most humble day of my life.
Those apologies were not enough. The Committee for Culture, Media and Sport today released its findings. Its 85-page report accuses Murdoch's News Corporation of willful blindness by ignoring evidence of widespread hacking. The report is extremely scathing about its corporate culture and the family in charge.
We found News Corporation carried out an extensive cover-up of its rampant law-breaking. Its most senior executives repeatedly misled Parliament, and the two men at the top, Rupert and James Murdoch, who were in charge of the company, must now answer for that.
Tom Watson is on the committee. He's at the forefront of a campaign to unearth the truth about illegal phone hacking. Watson holds Murdoch personally responsible.
More than any individual alive, he is to blame. Morally, the deeds are his. He paid the piper and he called the tune. It is his company, his culture, his people, his business, his failures, his lies, his crimes, the price of profits, and his power.
The report says testimony from Murdoch's British subsidiary, News International, misled the committee and therefore Parliament itself. So, it says, did three former executives: Les Hinton, Murdoch's right-hand man who headed News International, Tom Crone, the veteran News of the World lawyer, and the paper's editor, Colin Myler. Rupert Murdoch's son, James, also took a pounding. He was sent in to take charge of his father's British newspapers. The committee said it was astonished by what it called his lack of curiosity about illegal practices at the News of the World. On one crucial issue, the committee divided. All but one of its members are from the Conservative or Labour parties. They argued fiercely over one line.
The issue on which no Conservative member felt they could support the report itself was the line put in the middle of the report that said that Mr. Rupert Murdoch is not a fit person to run an international company.
Louise Mensch is a Conservative.
We all felt that was wildly outside the scope of a select committee, was an improper attempt to influence Ofcom and to tread on areas that is not the province of a select committee.
Ofcom regulates broadcasting in Britain. It's looking into whether the British satellite company BSkyB, under the control of the Murdochs, is fit to have a licence. Today's findings could prove significant. News Corporation has responded. It admits the report addresses some hard truths, but it also accuses the committee of making unjustified and partisan comments. How much damage all this is doing to News Corporation isn't yet clear. There's more to come. Scotland Yard still hasn't completed several very large investigations, and a major public inquiry triggered by the hacking scandal has yet to report.
I think there is the potential for this to really unravel. Whether it's the death knell remains to be seen.
Mark Watts authored a book on British newspaper journalism and is an expert on the Murdochs. He thinks US regulators may be very interested in the committee's findings.
Because corporate governance is a big a big issue for a major corporation to get right. And at the end of the day, the culture is set at the top. The person at the top is Rupert Murdoch, so he has to take responsibility for that. And he allowed this company to do what it was doing, and he didn't stop it.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.